What is up, y'all? Welcome to Tuesday Cannabis Insider. We're on a half hour earlier, Javier. It's like, what are we doing? It's like our egos are getting too big over here or something.
No, actually, this is a great time to tell our audience. This is Cannabis Hour No More. As you may remember, last Thursday was the last show of Cannabis Hour. Going forward, we'll be doing just Cannabis Insider every Tuesday and Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, right after market prep at the close.
We're going through a rebrand, y'all. This is press release worthy in the cannabis space. Rebrand. So welcome to Cannabis Insider's rebrand. We will be doing, in the future, it'll be a half hour show every Tuesday and Thursday at 4:30 Eastern time, or 4 Eastern time. Sorry, we decided 4 Eastern time. So excited about this, y'all. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to get some awesome interviews. We've had a great start to year, thanks to Javier and his amazing repertoire of guests. That being said, Javi, we have an incredible, incredible interview lined up for the day.
Man, so much fun. Today, our guest is Adam Bierman. He is the co-founder and former CEO of MedMen. You might have heard about them. Very, very interesting story over a decade in the cannabis industry. And this is, you know, his first tell-all since leaving the company a couple of years ago. Before that, a couple quick news items, and we'll make this one really quick this time around. My favorite news item of the day was Gary Chambers' campaign video. I don't know if you saw it. This guy from Louisiana is running for U.S. Senate, and he released a campaign video where he is smoking a sizable joint. Of course, highlighting the inequities of the war on drugs and you know, laws around marijuana. Very, very, very cool.
We should have gotten the video to play. That would have been awesome. Next time. You know what? We'll open next time with that. How about that?
Yes, sir.
Great. Louisiana. Wow. That's bold.
What you got?
That's awesome. Honestly, you got to give a shout out to Item 9 Labs. Stock skyrocketing. I think it was 20%, which for them, that's a big lift for Item 9 Labs historically. Oh, yeah. So they had 107% revenue growth. That's big. But Javier, there's a story I want your expertise on, because you've been looking at some of this information a lot longer than I have. And I want your thoughts on 1933, TGIFF acquires Day One Beverages, a sparkling CBD beverage company, which I think is super cool, expands their product portfolio. Nevada, kind of an up and down year, but overall a pretty great market, I think, in the industry. Mm-hmm. A lot of stock laid out for that. It was like some 55 million shares. Thoughts?
I like it very much. Very, awesome. Very, very cool. Go check out 1933. Two interesting data points on my end. You can check out the details on Benzinga.com/cannabis. One of them is related to cannabis and anxiety. A scholar explained what causes anxiety when we consume cannabis and what to do when smoking weed makes you paranoid. The other one is a study out of the University of Almeria in Spain. They looked into sex and cannabis and asked if weed enhances orgasm and sexual performance. Guess what? The answer is yes. That is a spoiler. Go to Benzinga.com/cannabis to find out why and how.
All right. And I got one more, and then feel free to wrap us up with something else, or we can move on to our interview. But I want to give a shout out to myself, because on Friday I listed my cannabis stocks to watch on Cannabis Daily. So Benzinga.com/podcasts. You can go and rewind. You can search for it. You can say, God, that guy's stupid. Or you can be like, I see what he's talking about. But I think I list out a lot of cool Canadian LPs, MSOs, ancillaries, internationals, and hopefully
the MSO gang is going to gang up on you.
I mean, I included some of their favorites, I think. I can't include all of them. Otherwise, why is it a stock pick show? That being said, there's a lot of great MSOs and a lot of great LPs. But specific stock shout outs, you got to give a shout out to Delta 9. DLTNF. Sorry, we got tongue tied on the ticker. DLTNF. Major revenue growth, I think, year over year. I think they're up to some 60 plus million on the year, as well as STEM Holdings. This is a big one, driven by STEM, actually, STMH on both on the OTC. I think up some 30 million year over year in their revenues. It's super impressive. Both of those stocks to me, super, super impressive to end the year.
Fantastic. I'm going to do a rapid fire round of news, and let's bring Adam on. MariMed, MRMD, became vertically integrated in Illinois after acquiring Green Growth. In Michigan, they are offering free pre-rolls for blood donations in a campaign they are calling Pot for Plasma. I love it. If you're in Michigan, go donate blood. Get a free pre-roll. I mean, you should do it anyways because it's, you know, what you should be doing. But definitely your pre-roll is an added bonus. And one of my favorite news items today as well, Generation Hemp teamed up with a cryptocurrency company to build energy plants, right? They want to use hemp feedstock as a fuel source.
That's so friggin' cool, man.
That is
honestly cool. Like it plays into a bit of the industrial hemp side. I mean, Generation Hemp has multiple uses, multiple ways to garner revenue. They're not just industrial, but that being said, they're not ignoring it either, like a lot of hemp companies are right now. This is super cool, super interesting partnership that could be the start of a wave. Money Mitch, love it. Plasma in a joint. Sounds like college. Awesome. Yeah. Honestly, that's probably the coolest news story I've seen in quite some time.
Love this. And with that, let's bring on Mr. Adam Bierman.
He is the
co-founder and former CEO of MedMen. If I'm not confused, the ticker is MMNFF on the OTC. Mr. Adam Bierman, welcome to Benzinga Cannabis Hour. No, Insider.
Insider.
Let's do it again.
You're kicked off, Javi. He's done. Adam, it's just you and me for the rest of the time.
I'm happy to be part of the rebrand. I'm happy to be helping you start what's next as we sit here and, you know, hopefully talk a little bit about, you know, what's next in everybody's lives. So happy to be here. Thanks for having me on. Very excited to do the show with you guys.
This is just perfect. Actually, I mean, Adam, for those who don't know who you are, what MedMen is, can you share, you know, the Cliff Notes, elevator pitch kind of version of your story in the cannabis space, a little bit about your background and MedMen, and, you know, we'll take it from there.
Sure. We started in the cannabis space, my partner and I, Andrew Modlin, in 2010 with our first store. And over about a decade, we built from a single store to multiple stores. We went from multiple stores to multi-state. And, you know, we went from private to public. We went from not raising money to raising a lot of money. We were the first in, you know, in so many of these kind of categories, or the first to knock down so many of these walls that, or doors, if you will, that now, you know, everybody else has passed through. As we look at a landscape today of these public companies that are well capitalized with real momentum on the regulatory side. So we were the first cannabis unicorn, first $1 billion valuation in cannabis in history in the U.S. We were the first cannabis private equity fund to raise money to deploy into plant touching businesses. And I think we were the first nationally unionized or union friendly, union partnered cannabis business. Changed a lot of laws. Raised a lot of money, bought a lot of assets, built a lot of stores, broke a lot of stuff, pissed a lot of people off, made a lot of mistakes, learned a lot of lessons, and, you know, along the way had that North Star the whole time of making the world a better place through access to legal regulated cannabis.
Now, can we start with the rise of MedMen? Because you guys, you know, were the darling of the industry. I mean, I don't know how else to say that. MedMen was... And I think widely is still considered one of the most reputable and recognizable names in cannabis. So, you know, when we think about how you got there, you know, one of the first to raise capital, but you did it in different ways. You know, you went and attacked investors that I think other companies maybe didn't attack. I mean, do you want to dive into maybe some of the details of how you did things a little differently to get to where you got to? And then operationally, we can go into more on, you know, maybe some of the issues with that later on.
Sure. I mean, I think the biggest thing is just that we were doing things for the first time. And so, and we were doing things, and in us actually executing on our plan, we were changing the way, you know, our society operates, right? And when you change anything, you are moving pieces around and you are displacing people, which inevitably means you're pissing groups off, right? So, and, you know, when you're being the first, right, you're going to get somebody to want to partner with you after getting everybody to say no to you. And those people that said no to you, right, they want to be right, right? So, for example, yeah, we were the first people not one of the first. I mean, we were the first people to raise money, you know, loud and proud for plant touching businesses in the US at scale, right? We raised nine figures in that private equity fund. And the lawyers, for example, who wrote up the fund documents, when I asked them to do it, they laughed at me, right? It was laughable because page one of the private equity fund subscription document said, warning, you know, this is a federally illegal business and these lunatics are going to invest in these businesses that aren't even federally allowed to be open. But if you want, they're raising $100 million, right? So when you're having to do things like that, the people that will invest, right, into this, which will be the first, right, those aren't necessarily the long-term partners for the industry or me or MedMen, right? Those are just people or organizations in that moment that, you know, could partner with us to move everything forward. Now, post that happening, right, everything improves. People get better. You know, as people see that the world doesn't fall down, investments get repaid, an industry is healthy for the world and society, more people want to invest, more money is available, more investment bankers want to take companies public, right? All these things started to happen. But, you know, along the way, whether we were the first company to write big checks to change laws and, you know, that was really difficult because it put pressure on everybody else to do it. Or we were the first people to go on television and say, you know, we are a marijuana company and we're proud of it. We're not pretending that we're anything other than what we are. We had to do those things just to create what we were able to create. I think what MedMen is today and going forward, right, it'll have its new life, right? It'll have its next life as the industry now has its next life to and through the end of Prohibition. But those first moments, right, we had to beg, borrow, and steal our way, making it up along the way. There's so much. I think we have an hour. Happy to talk about any parts that you think are most interesting.
You know, before we get into the controversy, right, I am an internationally focused guy. And one of the things that has obsessed me about MedMen over the years is the construction of such a strong brand, right? It's if you look at the cannabis world, you know, there's only a handful of brands that are recognized globally. You know, you can say High Times, right? And you can say Raw Rolling Papers. As far as cannabis, like, you know, cannabis producers or companies selling cannabis, there's just Cookies and MedMen. And I can tell you that from talking to friends all around the world, they often ask me, hey, when is MedMen coming to Argentina? When is MedMen coming to Barcelona? When is MedMen coming to Berlin? Wherever, right? And I know this was a very you know, intentional process, right? You opened a store on Fifth Avenue and in New York in Manhattan. You did a commercial with Spike Jonze. So I mean, can you tell us a little bit about why you chose to go through this path and focus so much on building a brand and recognition?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something I'm so proud of and I'm so excited to talk about. But in a weird way, right, this story is a very, very big reason why I'm talking to you today, not as the CEO of MedMen, and why MedMen's gone through a restructuring, a repositioning, and everything else, right? It's one of these things that you can't have one without the other. And that's, I think, you know, I've had time to reflect over the last couple of years to kind of, you know, to understand that. I don't know if that makes sense.
Totally.
So sorry, back to your question before I've laid that out. So go ahead.
No, I mean, my question generally was like, why such a big focus on building a brand, right? When no one was really focused so much on that, because now, like in retrospect, it's easy to go like, yeah, brands are, you know, what's really going to drive cannabis retail forward. But like 2, 3, 5 years ago, no one was focused on this. And in fact, people were dissing MedMen for, you know, focusing so much on brand building, you know. Oh, Spike Jonze this, the Fifth Avenue that. For me, it was like, dude, this is very important to the mainstream of cannabis.
So here's the answer, right, on the brand. So my time at MedMen, right, I've never had a candid conversation as Adam Bierman with you guys, right, talking as an individual, looking at the world, being honest, right? I've always had a hat on. You know, and during my time at MedMen, right, my hat, during the time you're talking about, I wore a hat of being the spokesperson for the company, MedMen. I had the hat of being, you know, a spokesperson for the industry, right? Regulatory and kind of like a permanent place in our society, you know, mainstreaming marijuana across, you know, all aspects. And with those hats on, right, we had to make decisions. And so, for example, if I'm building a company while building an industry, because without an industry, there is no company at first, right? How do you get people to recognize and respect the fact that there's a permanent opportunity or inevitability to this industry, right? Before MedMen, there wasn't an investor, a banker, a news reporter, you know, or anybody else that drives culture, drives society's thoughts, thought leaders. Nobody believed, thought leaders in mainstream, or barely anybody believed, that there was a permanent place in mainstream society for cannabis, right? And again, I'm saying that I am here and I have been through this journey because I fundamentally believe that access to legal cannabis makes the world safer, healthier, and happier, right? But nobody believed that. So what did we have to do to make people believe that? We had to open a store on Fifth Avenue so people in Buenos Aires would talk about it, right? We had to provide this service so that when people flew into LA from Buenos Aires and went to a MedMen store, somebody was there to greet them at the front and say, welcome to the future, right? That person at the front costs a lot of money, right? That person at the front, they're creating an experience. That's an investment in a brand is what you're talking about, Javier, right? So when we were thinking about, and I was always thinking about, if I don't find a permanent place for the industry, there is no company, there is no MedMen, right? We were doing both things at the same time. And for a while, MedMen was able to keep up as a company, the industry, right, to prove the next part of the industry. New York had to become legitimized. If New York's not going to go, right, then the U.S. is not going to go. Well, what is the first step to put a flag in the ground and say, I'll bet that I know more than you and New York's going to go and you should follow? It's MedMen opening a store on Fifth Avenue. Right. And so what does that do? That builds a global brand, because to your point, nobody else was doing it. To our benefit, we were the first of all these things. As a result, on the other side, as a result, we made significant investments in being first in midterm kind of return scenarios. And when the market flipped and wanted short term, you know, viability and conservative outlook, right, MedMen goes upside down. Right. So again, it's one of those things that without it, we're not, there's no show today in the exact same way that this show's happening, right? There's still a show, there's still an industry, it's not the same. But also without us going there, you know, then MedMen is something completely different. So I don't know if that makes sense, but it was about building an industry, building permanence, and making people, you know, I remember when the Kardashians had a birthday party on one of the reality shows and there was a bag on the thing and on my phone is blowing up. It's like, We didn't pay to have that place there, but we built such a strong brand and a welcoming environment with people that the famous people on television were willing to go shop there and put it on their show as a badge. Hey, this is a badge. Now people in Buenos Aires or in Rome, Italy, or wherever else, they're saying marijuana, that mainstream part of pop culture. Oh, okay. Maybe it's not as bad as I've been told growing up. And now the world opens, right?
Now, Adam, this is super interesting, man. You're talking about culture and the culture of cannabis. But, you know, now, as recently as the last MJ BizCon in November, there's a panel on culture and corporate cannabis, how the two are separated and how they are able to work together. And there's many people, especially in the West Coast and maybe these older markets, who think that this corporate version of cannabis is not beneficial to the overall culture of cannabis. But some would argue that MedMen started that wave. But it seems to me that you claim the culture part. So I'd love to hear from you where MedMen sits in this culture and corporate cannabis discussion.
It's the evolution of time and generations, right? And that's how the world works. Somebody's really, really dumb until they're really smart, until they're dumb again. Somebody's really successful until they fail, until they have success again. This is life, right? So, you know, the way that I think about this is me, right, is it all makes sense. So if you look at, you know, the beginnings of all of this movement, right, you really go back pre-Steve D'Angelo, right, you go back into Vietnam War protests, you know, cannabis should be legal, you move into marijuana policy project, and we should take this seriously, we'll have a DC lobby, we're going to do this, take us seriously, you know, shocking the world. And legalizing in Colorado for a few million dollars. Do people know that today? Do we know that Colorado was the first place in the world to legalize weed, and Marijuana Policy Project did it for a couple million dollar budget when no one was watching and changed the world and shifted our future? Like, right. So you have, you know, all these participants, right, that are giving their lives to push this, you know, evolve this forward. And by the time you get to 2010 and me and Andrew, right, we're just those people in that place where, you know, the D'Angelo brothers are running Harborside with all the respect in the world, doing an incredible job of being out there and saying, we have a marijuana dispensary. We are a real business. We are law abiding citizens. We're not crazy criminals. Like, they did such an amazing job. You know, you had that generation that did those reality TV shows out in Colorado, right? Hey, there's a lot of money here. These are real people. They're real business people. And then, you know, Andrew and I show up in 2010, post me personally bearing witness to the online poker boom that took place a decade earlier through family experience, and me saying, you know, holy shit, right? This is what I just saw in online gaming, where something where there is demand goes from inaccessible to accessible, right? Which, let's not talk too much about poker, but cannabis goes from inaccessible to accessible. And once it's accessible, right, people aren't scared or they're not as stigmatized about it. We saw almost half of the United States place a bet online at the height of the online gaming boom in the early 2000s. I saw this when we get introduced in 2010 going, oh my God, this makes people healthier, happier. This makes the world better. And the people that use this stuff don't talk to the people that don't about it because of the stigma. This will end. Right. And so it's just us being the perfect people at the perfect time, not the smartest, not the wittiest, not the, any of those things. We just, for $13,000, we start what is MedMen, right? We open our first store. We get to see that world. And I start asking, why not? Why can't we legitimize it? Why can't I have a vape pen in my mother-in-law's purse? Why can't we have a Spikes Jones Super Bowl ad, which that was supposed to be, Javier, right? It's some ad that not many people know about. That was supposed to be the first Super Bowl ad in the history of weed. And if it was, it would have been a banger, right? So this is just, you know, this is what we do over 10 years. And I think, you know, for us, it's like, we're just the perfect people at the perfect time. Now, let's say you're at the 5-yard line at the end of Prohibition. We're not the right people. I'm not the right person to be the face and the CEO of a company that's sitting down with, you know, ex investment banker, the SEC, you know, the DOJ, whoever it is, to talk about, we're going to list on the NYSE, right? Here's our executive suite. And I'm not the right person for that, right? So when we talk about this corporate cannabis, you know, people talking, first of all, people will always hate with whoever's in charge, which, you know, firsthand, you know, knowledge of that. These are the right people. And I have so much respect for all the way down from, you know, Boris to Ben. And I've never met Kim, but I think she's done an incredible job. You know, Charlie at Cresco, these people are incredible. And these are the shepherds of what we've all done into the end zone. Once it gets to the end zone and Altria can play, once we get to the end zone and Couche-Tard can play, once we get to the end zone and LVMH can play, you know, then these people, some will evolve. Some of these executives will evolve and the rest of it. And then, you know, some will evolve to what's next. This is the evolution of things. My biggest issue, and then I'll shut up about this, with this whole corporate cannabis, not good for the industry, this or that. And I couldn't say this, or I didn't have the balls to say this when I was at MedMen, is, you know, oh, I'm a cannabis CEO, but I don't smoke weed. That stuff bothers me to no end, right? You know, the Sam Adams, you know, CEO proudly not only drinks beer, but is an aficionado and shows up on TV commercials to say, you see, I'm putting my stamp on it. Why at a conference for investors do the executives for cannabis companies have to pretend not to be cannabis users, right? Those aren't the people that should be making decisions about the future of an experience and an interaction with consumers. In my opinion, it doesn't happen in any other space. Big pharma CEOs don't say, when I get sick, naked juicing, you know, that doesn't happen. But in cannabis, it still goes on because of the stigma, right? Mm-hmm. And I won't put up with it, but that's also why I'm not the right guy to be there today. I have no problem with those people. I think they're amazing, and I would bet a lot of money, and I have, into their public equities that I think will be worth a lot as we get to and through the end of Prohibition.
Nice. No, I mean, you know, let's move a little bit forward with the story, right? We're approaching the corner of this first block, right? And you hit the epitome of the mainstream after being parodied by South Park, right? And as you said, people will hate on whomever is on top. So you're on top right here, and you're about to acquire, merge, you know, with Pharmaca, and you're close to $1 billion valuation, and you're about to close in an $800 million deal, and it falls through. What happened there? you know, and that is kind of the start of a spiral down, right? So, and there's no way to sugarcoat this. So what happened? You know, what happened? What was your part in it? What, you know, could he have been done better? What, you know, generally, what happened there?
Did I cut out? Or you guys still?
No, Javier is a choppy, but if you want to just dive into the PharmaCann story for us, and we'll let him come back.
Sure. I think, you know, when you talk about like that really being the start of a downward death spiral of the MedMen stock at that time, it certainly was one of the, you know, one of the big drivers. But just like, you know, if you said, what was the big driver to take a company that you couldn't raise at a $20 million valuation for 5 years later to be worth $2 billion? It'd be like, well, here are the three big things, but here's a million stories. So, you know, if you say, well, I believe, you know, if you look at the charts, it's undeniable. This is the moment in time when the PharmaCann deal breaks. Like, yeah, that's undeniable. There's two big catalysts for it. And then there's a million stories. And because I'm out now, we'll talk about whatever you want to. But, you know, I wasn't aware until this past year, you know, the biggest, what I think, driver for it failing was, and it was the Department of Justice and the Attorney General. Right, this is how crazy, at least my life was at the time, and this is how crazy it was in this evolution, this time frame of the evolution of cannabis, right? The industry was, there was a whistleblower case in the AG's office, and in the testimony last year, it was indirect to what the whistleblower's case was, you know, the Attorney General of the United States instructing the people who worked for him to block the MedMen PharmaCann trial.
That's insane.
Right. Wow. So, you know, I didn't know that at the time. It was, again, the first. So this is the theme, the good and the bad, right? So this was the first time a cannabis transaction like that had to go through the antitrust process in the U.S. in the Department of Justice. Well, just think about that. It's a federally illegal business, but it qualifies to have to go through, you know, this process. So what a confusing place for the DOJ to be in. Bet your ass, as soon as we got through it, right, which took, you know, 1 year too long and blew the deal up, everybody else did the same thing, right? All the people that are there today benefited from the fact that it's called HSR, right? That we actually, even though the AG said block that, we got through it, but it took too long, right? It should have taken 6 months. It took 12 months, you know, and all the uncertainty around it really screwed with us. And it put us upside down because we made such an investment in integrating those two companies over the period of a year, just to have that rug pulled out from underneath us there after a year of it. And then the street expecting it. It's a horrible spot. At the time, I thought there were other reasons. Those same reasons exist. That's the million stories. But the big thing behind it is it should have just been approved. HSR should have expired in 6 months. We would have put the two companies together and then you have a different story. But it didn't happen. And as a result, we were very upside down and we were in the direct crosshairs of a predatory lender. And that was a war that, you know, I had been fighting for some time. And that was a war that, you know, ultimately I didn't survive from.
And looking at the negotiations of that deal, you know, and you know, I would say the timing that took for the U.S. government to respond to you was probably the biggest issue you're saying, right, from what I'm gathering. So probably investor weariness, investor skittishness, lots of issues on the investor front. But in terms of negotiations of that deal and composing it, how exactly would that be different nowadays? You know, just for those of us who've never put together a merger.
Yeah, so I mean, a great example, and I didn't follow it with enough detail, right? But a great example is when Harvest Kim, who's Kim? Trulieve. When Trulieve acquires Harvest, right? I don't know, but I assume there isn't a question mark of whether it'll close. I assume you aren't talking about HSR, the 6 month process. You know what kind of, because everybody's has come through. Does that make sense? Right. So when you say, how is it different now? It's we went and fought this fight where we were in the crosshairs of the Attorney General of the United States to have marijuana companies be able to pass this HSR approval process. We were the first people to hire a law firm of that ilk in D.C. to go work, you know, with the DOJ on that. Right. Who do you think now represents the companies as they go through these mergers. So how would it be different now? There's a roadmap, right? We got to have enough success and screw enough things up to at least create the first of its roadmap, which other people are able to refine and execute on top of and be better at.
And with, there you are, Gabby.
Yeah, I don't know if you can hear me. There's something weird going on with Chrome. So big shout out to my favorite browser, Firefox, which never fails. let me ask you this. What are people missing? What do they have wrong? What do they get wrong about this story? What do they get right again? You know, like if you had to do a little bit of a mea culpa.
Well, I don't know what people. Are you talking about my wife? Are you talking about the people that are watching your show, or, you know, who are we talking about?
Yeah, investors. I mean, generally Wall Street and Main Street.
Sure. I think this is just a story. This is a situation where a lot of this, in my opinion now, was inevitable, right? And within that inevitability, right, the caricature of the first by the media and, you know, society at large, you know, I believe was going to be what it was going to be, right? Because the first was going to have to be bold enough to grab a spotlight, shine it on, you know, the industry, their company, and themselves as a way to go ahead and create permanence. That was going to happen, whether it was me or somebody else, right? And so, you know, I think it's like the caricature of that individual. You talk about South Park, right? I would think, oh, who's that person going to be? It's going to be some privileged young kid who's willing to take a bunch of risks, who's not the smartest person. So they're not having like a regular buttoned up kind of thing. They take a shot in weed. They get a bunch of opportunities through their parents and, you know, some government connections that they have. They do crazy drugs, stay up all night and party in private jets and carry around handguns with models. Like, that's who that person is, right? Like, that's the lazy, easy caricature. And because I was building an asset class, an industry, a company, right, had all these hats on, I never, and this is probably, you know, was a mistake, I never went ahead and said, okay, now here's my hat, right? And because I never did that, you know, I never had social media. I've never logged into Facebook. Mm-hmm. I've never presented anything. I'm a very private person. Now coming back, I will have social media. You know, like me, love me, hate me, whatever. At least I want people to at least understand and know. So I think what people would be missing is they just don't know anything. So probably some of what they think is true is true. Probably some of the worst parts that they think or judge are true, right? And probably like some of the best parts, but they don't know the story, right? That's what's missing is we got to tell the story because there's so much to learn, not only for everybody's individual life, but there's so much to learn from a collective industry's perspective, so that we can continue to push this ball forward.
Like there's this rapper who's very cannabis friendly called The Game, and he has this song. He says, "Hate it or love it, the underdog's on top." I don't know. It just made me think of that. You go, Eli. You know,
and that's the thing, right? Like that person, if I was going to be the caricature, that person had to be the underdog that was hated. Like that's just what they get wrong. Here's what they get wrong. Okay. Here's what they get right. Let's start there and let's have some humility. To answer your question, because let's do it. So here's what they get right. I was young. I was inexperienced. I was bold. I was brash. I was at the point in many instances of the decision-making I had a tremendous ego. I would not take no for an answer. I was naive to a lot of the parts of what I would have to do as the CEO, as the company grew. I was naive, you know, out of my inexperience, out of my lack of education. All of that is true, right? And so, great, you know, I own all of that. And, you know, that's about me learning, right? And I love weed for that. I'm gonna be a cannabis person to say I smoke weed every day and it helps me be a better person. And part of what I love about weed is it helps me be honest about all that stuff, right? It helps me be honest that as I stare at my 40th birthday, which is in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you know, I can say, I wouldn't wanna hang out with my 30-year-old self. Like, you know, I don't know. I can honestly say that. How many of us do, but I'm not judging other people, but I don't even wanna hang out with my 35-year-old self. I'm embarrassed. But I also understand that my 35-year-old self was the only person at that time that could do what they did to create permanence for this marijuana industry. The guy I am today couldn't have done that. No way. You know, way too many decisions that were way too overly risked, way too much personal exposure, way too, you know, just all of it, just way too, I wouldn't have done it. But back then, that kid did it. So good for us. We're here today. So all those things are true. All those things are true. And then I think, you know, what's also true is, you know, I started this with $13,000. I started this without a car. I had a beach cruiser bicycle that we put the weed in, and I drove it, rode it down the street to the dispensary where the guy let me rent the place for a few thousand a month. That's how we started, right? That's also true. And at a certain point, once I could rent, lease a Prius and have an apartment, I was good. And it, this became passion for me, right? Like, that's all true as well. When you see me speaking, or even now me getting into it, this is true. I am passionate about this. I do believe marijuana makes the world safer, healthier, and happier, right? And I did make the effort, you know, to go create an inclusive community at MedMen, the first 1,000-plus employee national marijuana company, right? To have healthcare and benefit, all the union stuff, you know, and all the money we put in, and time and energy we put into changing laws, you know, to expunge records. All of that's true too. It's true that a lot of investors made a fortune with us, right? We started with nothing. And, you know, if you invested when the company was valued at $20 million and sold when it was valued at this, you made a fortune. A lot of people made a fortune. A lot of retail investors invested at the top, and it's down 95%. All of that's true, right? And all of that, I believe, right, is real. I believe a lot of it was inevitable. Some of it was circumstantial based on who was in the chair. And all we can do is learn from it.
Well, Adam, I'm 30, so I'm glad to hear it gets better. but secondly, man, you know, I want to look a little bit more toward today through your lens, you know, through the lens of your experience. And I want to specifically center this question around talent acquisition. And I know, you know, getting executives and luring them was an issue, you know, at least back in the day. Nowadays, you see bankers, you see lawyers, you see investors and people with capital backgrounds, people with, you know, CPG backgrounds galore from Grubhub and so on and so forth. I mean, how do you look at that and say, you know, if one sect is better, or it's good to have legacy growers in the head chair, and it's good to have investment bankers behind them. I'm curious how you look at the lens of executives today. You talked about you love the executives leading the top tier companies. I'm just curious, do you see the differences in leadership between these different backgrounds?
Evolution, inevitable evolution, right? So, you know, you talk about hate and whatever, you know, and I even said, like, people want to hate on the people that are always in charge. So whoever's running it now is the worst, and then whoever replaces them is the worst. I remember the first time I received hate, and I think it was like the second or third annual MJ Biz conference. And it was in, I think, Seattle at a racetrack. Right now, like, I get goosebumps, right? I can't go to Vegas in November because I drive down the strip and see everybody with the badges on, the 50,000 people, and I get goosebumps. Like, dude, I remember when it was, you know, 240, you know, long-haired Birkenstock people at a dog in Seattle, right? And now people are like, to your point, right? They're like, I am a weed banker. I am a weed this. Like, it's a real industry, right? People have real careers. That's evolution. Anyways, the first time I really received hate was I went and spoke up at this conference, and most of the people there were legacy growers because it was in the Northwest and whatever it was. And I get up on the stage again. I don't like that kid that I was at 31 or whenever it was when this happened, but that kid got up on stage in a suit and tie and said, if you don't evolve, you will die. And the future of this is corporate because it's too big and it's going to be too widespread accepted, right? And worth too much for it to stay in mom and pop hands. So you have a chance to evolve with it and create value for yourself and actually make the industry better. And they literally, like, if they had tomatoes, they would have thrown them at my head, right? That was the first time I received hate. And that was the first time I talked about this topic. One of my biggest issues at MedMen, back to the inevitability of going through this cycle with MedMen, is I couldn't recruit talent. How about how crazy this is? There were no recruiters that would recruit for cannabis. Right now you have people going to MJ Biz in Vegas with the black plant, you know, things on their chest, pay $3,000 to get in, and they say, I'm a cannabis recruiter. I'm a cannabis HR professional. Do you realize, can I, you know, 100 emails to the top 100 recruiting firms in the world? Nobody would, because of reputational risk, nobody will do it. We couldn't recruit. we need those people in our industry to transition to what's next, right? Because without permanence, creativity, artistry, culture, without a permanent place financially in our society, those things can't exist. So for everybody who cares about how good the weed is that they smoke, or how clean it is, or how tested it is, or how accessible it is, then you need to want to see a step up in the corporate game in cannabis. Now, with permanence, with successful businesses, you want to see GTI hiring those people. You want them bringing on as, you know, an assistant to the CEO, as a special advisor to the head of marketing, right? That's the place. But, you know, if this is about, well, the legacy growers should be growing weed, well, then we don't have a sustainable industry because they're uninvestable, right? Because no big investment bank is going to invest in them when they have a Excel spreadsheet with audited financials and say, is this an invest? No, it's not happening. It's got to be under GTI. But there's nothing wrong with that. As a stoner, there's nothing wrong with that. That means we are protected. What a great place to be in.
Now, staying a little bit on topic, right? You've already shared your thoughts on Kim Rivers at Trulieve and Charlie Batchel at Cresco and Ben Cobbler at GTI. You know, but you know, talking about the executives themselves, which companies do you like? What are you looking at? You know, are you investing your own money? You know, what are you bullish on in the cannabis?
Give us some stock picks, Adam. Come on.
Yep.
Well, without me giving you picks, because that's your job, not mine, to the experts, you know, I just took a lot of stock in parent company. You know, we executed on a proof of concept retail roll-up strategy here in California. We took a year, invested a few dollars, and we built and sold a concept called Coastal to parent company for $56 million. You know, that was like a 70% stock deal or something like that. You know, that's my cash in that deal that now is converted to parent co stock, right? So we obviously like that equity. I think, you know, but that's just reflective of the insanity in the public markets today and the disconnect between what's going on in the ground and where these companies are valued, right? Those guys are trading at less than cash with a couple hundred million of revenue, and they just acquired Coastal, which is the most profitable retail chain in the state at the time of acquiring it, and their stocks, you know, whatever it is. So, you know, I believe there's an arbitrage that is inevitable, and I believe that most investors believe it as well. And it's just, it's the fear factor and it's the uncertainty over time, right? At the end of prohibition, decriminalization, recriminalization, rescheduling, descheduling, legalization, taxing, I don't care what you call it, right? At the point in time in which you can have domestic listings for US plant touching cannabis companies, you will have, you know, these companies get indexed, get an influx of volume, all the things that happen. Tilray is $150 stock for 2 months when it's the craziest, right? You will have GTI and Cura and all these people list on the New York Stock Exchange. The arbitrage between, for example, parent company on the NEO exchange with $1,000 of volume and no analyst coverage, right? Trading at something that makes no sense. And then being on the New York Stock Exchange with real analyst coverage, real banking, you know, you know, the arbitrage there on top of the bubble, right? So one is they're undervalued by 5x or whatever the number is that you guys will say. And then there's this factor of the fact that the growth opportunity is almost unlimited once they get to the NYSE. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I like the more sizable players because I think they're, for the most part, all undervalued because I think that arbitrage exists for everybody between illegal and legal. And if you believe it will be legal or decriminalized, then you're buying into that arb. On the smaller micro cap kind of public market stuff, you know, I believe a lot of those will go away. I believe a lot of them will fail, right? They just weren't built for success. I believe you'll see some grand slams. I believe some of them will figure it out. It's about consolidation, right? They'll combine together in a sober manner and create, you know, competitors to the GTIs and Curas. I think you'll see that happen. And the people that make the bets right on those guys while they're sitting here trading at sub $100 million market caps, I think there's a lot of upside there.
The parent company, that's Jay-Z, right? You met him?
I've met him. We, you know, it's as me, I can talk about it, right? Like, you know, that's a deal that I put together at MedMen, right? Nobody knows that. Again, what do they know? What do they not know, right? I just never have talked about it before. But, you know, Jay Brown was on our board. And you know, we had been working for a while to do that exact deal. In fact, it was funny because when they announced that deal, it was post me leaving MedMen, Jay-Z's title at that company is a title we came up with, right? So, you know, it's like, this is what he's doing now, and this is what, you know, Roc Nation is doing, and I think it's amazing. I wish him nothing but the best. Back to being first, we put the deal together. We lubricated the deal, and then we have this, you know, unfortunate James Parker lawsuit, which you haven't even asked me about yet. See, I said you can ask me about anything, which, you know, finally ended. But once that happened, and in addition to PharmaCann, we were in that, you know, horrible cycle, and I couldn't, we couldn't, in good conscience on both sides, sign that deal and start with their reputation and the fact that they'd be making such a big commitment, right? So we never had a chance for it to blow over. I end up departing the company and they go make that deal. So, you know, I wish them nothing but the best. But yeah, parent company.
James Parker. I mean, James Parker, you brought it up, right? You had a CFO.
It's over. Time's over. I can't hear you, Javier.
You can hear me, Phil?
Oh, no, he can hear you. He can hear you, Javi. Perfect. He's not getting away that easily.
You had a CFO, you know, who was terminated in 2019. He sued the company for, what, like $24 million. What happened there, right? Was he right? Was he wrong? You know, what happened?
I mean, is this like a real emotional Barbara Walters moment, or do you just want the facts like a ruthless investor?
Give us emotion with the facts.
Wow. Okay. Well, here are the facts. The facts are that, you know, I couldn't find great talent, as I said, right? And so we went public, myself included, with a CEO that was inexperienced for that role, right? And we went public with a CFO that had never been a CFO before. Now he was the only CFO that was willing to do it at the time when, you know, I recruited the guy for years to say yes, even though he was mediocre, because that was the best we could get, you know. I even remember when James came, he's like, I can never go back to the real world, so it'll have to make it in weed. And, you know, as the company, you know, grew, and as those responsibilities became greater for him as a CFO of public, he couldn't do the job. And as opposed to facing the music, he walked out in the middle of the day. And in California, you can walk out and sue people. I mean, that's just what happens, right? So he walked out and he tried to extort us. And, you know, I had been, again, I can say this, right? I had been extorted for a couple of years up to this point in time, right? The media, because we were building an industry, there had to be permanence. People expected us to be these guys, right? So I was so paranoid always about our reputation, which is crazy because the reputation was inevitable. But I was always paranoid to make it true. How about that? And so, you know, we had been extorted before with people walking out, claiming stuff in employment, having to pay them. You know, this person said, this general manager said this word, just pay them, because we didn't want them going to the press. We didn't want it to be a thing, right? We were building the reputation for an industry and a company. So, you know, Parker takes it to the full extreme and he walks out in the middle of a financing. If you really want to talk about the spiral and, you know, you guys, public markets guys, the PharmaCann deal falls apart. The biggest lender in the company now is a predatory lender who has deal docs with us that, with that deal falling apart, just has us completely square, right, in the crosshairs. And I now have to go raise money in the middle of the night because we expected for the deal to close and then we had money lined up to invest into the combined business. So now I have to go to new sources in the middle of the night to raise money. And, you know, one of the million stories is in the middle of the night, I fly into Toronto and I sneak into a hotel and I go up the elevator and the CEO of Canaccord comes to meet me once nobody's paying attention. They, you know, we sit down and we shake hands on a financing in the middle of the night for $100 million. Right. And it's like, oh my God, I remember calling Andrew saying, Andrew, I'm never going to do this again. Like, I know that deal screwed us, but that's why we'll never do another M&A deal, but I can't, you know, that was too close. And Parker, because he had been failing at work, he walked out after that happened. So he walks out and says, hey, you need a CFO to sign your financing docs. I want $10 million. And it was like, for some reason, it was the last straw for me. Again, right or wrong, right? I felt like at some point I had to put my foot down. And, you know, I think at that time it led to this spiral. Sorry, guys, is this light screwing with me?
No. We can see it
to my face. So at this point, it led to the spiral, but I did. I put my foot down and we decided as a group, the board and myself, right? We said, we're not going to pay them. We won't be extorted. So I called the bank, Canaccord, and I said, hey, look, this is the deal with my CFO. what do you want to do? And the market had tanked from the time we inked the bought deal to the time I make this phone call. And we, you know, agreed to adjust the deal so the investors that invested before the market tanked, not related to MedMen, weren't underwater on it, and we took the sizing down. And so we printed that deal, and we told Parker, you know, we weren't going to be extorted. And then he went ahead and he sued me and sued us, but it wasn't for, he sued us for constructive discharge. As you know, Javier, like, that's not that exciting. He added in there, I mean, he just hit every box, right? We're racist, we're this-ists on everything. And that was one of the toughest nights of my life when I got a preview of that lawsuit. So there's the Barbara Walters thing, but it was, it was a really tough, you know, punch in the gut. And it really was just part of this downward spiral for me fighting and kind of losing that last, you know, 6 months before I'm out of MedMen. PharmaCann breaks, you know, I print this deal in the middle of the night. Parker walks out and tries to extort us. We say no, the deal has to get repriced. And the whole market's just like, you know, the street's like, what the hell is going on over there? You know, and I'm waking up every day in a bloodbath, in a war, right? So that's what happens with Parker. You fast forward 3.5 years and it went to trial. And we just got done with trial at the end of last year. And, you know, the record now about his lies is cemented in that verdict, right? And the real story. The other thing is the real story around MedMen and the birth of this whole industry and our part in it. I can talk about it now, right? We couldn't really talk when we were, you know, he said you're this and they said you did this. But, you know, we come back, not only did the jury find that we did none of the stuff, but the jury found that he actually injured the company and he did a bunch of bad stuff. And they were debating whether that he had to pay the company. So, you know, it's nice, you know, to have it be over. It's unfortunate that that's part of the history. But again, wasn't that inevitable? Wasn't it inevitable if you could only get mediocre talent, you had a $1 billion-plus company, that eventually somebody was going to go the whole way to try to extort you with salacious lies to get paid 7 figures or 8 figures in his case, right? Like, just happened to be us. So it's over now. That guy is, you know, the worst kind of human, the human that, you know, wants to go ahead and do nothing but, you know, reap and benefit from other people so they can be lazy for the rest of their lives. So, you know, that's the end of him. We move on now, you know, look into what's next.
And we'll get into what's next. We have 7 minutes left. I wanted to one more spicy question, and then, you know, I'm sure Elliot has the last question. My spicy question relates to home growing, right? The famous, you know, there was a lot of chat about MedMen lobbying against home growing. Was that true? Was that false? If it was true, why? You know, what's the story there?
Great. So there's a thing where, like, yeah, of course it's true. And then what's the whole story, right? And so, of course it's true. Why is it true? Because there were states that we were trying to change laws in where we were contributing the most amount of money. We were contributing the most amount of time. We were the ones waving our hands saying, come on, everybody. We got to back the people that are changing the laws. We got to participate to create, you know, a permanent future. And also on the other side of things, when you talk about prison reform and, you know, social justice and everything else, like, you know, we have to end this, right? So we're there trying to make this happen. And in many cases, you'd be across from people in government that make laws that you have to partner with that would say, we can get behind this, but we can't get behind homegrown. And to me, it was crazy.
Why?
It's like, does anybody have a problem with people? I don't grow my own tomatoes. I go to the farmer's market or Whole Foods. Like, why is home growing anything a problem? People in our society don't grow stuff at home, right? Like, so I never had a problem with it. I think it's great. You know, like, plenty of my friends grow their weed at home, bring it to me, and that's what I smoke. It's awesome. But, you know, if it's between, you know, people not having legal access, right, whether they're medical patients or adult use, and the only way you're going to get certain politician to support the beginning of the program is to have no home grow, then to me, it's very easy. As Adam Beer, not even industry, as me, it's like, great. Yeah. Every program evolves. It starts and then it opens. You got to start it. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, I mean, we were fighting trying to legalize weed and make sure they wouldn't go to jail anymore for it.
Very nice. Good answer, Adam. So with our few minutes remaining here, can you give a minute or two, you know, talk about Adam, talk about what's next for you. You have equity in the parent company, but cannabis. I mean, are you sticking with cannabis? Is this where you will live and evolve for the foreseeable future?
I mean, I love cannabis. I love this plant. I love what it does for me and my family. I love what it does, like, for our society. I am passionate about it, and I'll continue to be passionate about it. I just love what's next. You know, and I think what's next will involve cannabis for me for a while, but I just love what's next, you know? So, yeah, we've got a retail roll up in California. We're crossing brands over into THC, mainstream brands that you would know, whether they make cookies or sell beer. You know, I believe there's a future where, you know, companies are looking to capture your share of wallet and they include THC, right? Right now, your wallet has THC. If you live in California, as part of what you spend monthly, you know, I believe In-N-Out, that might be the best example, but I believe In-N-Out not only wants your fast food dollars, they want your THC dollars, right? As they should. And so, you know, we're looking to help those kind of really popular brands cross over and be able to offer THC to a loyal following. I think that's really cool. And what's next? You know, and this will probably, you know, or maybe sound crazy, but I still believe that the most important marijuana market in the world is still the marijuana marketplace with the most growth potential. You know, I still believe that California is the most important market and it's not even scratched the surface. So, you know, we're very bullish on California. I love the metaverse. I believe there's a convergence between cannabis and the metaverse. I think that, you know, NFTs are the future of loyalty programs. But what's next? You know, how can we push this envelope forward and continue to ask why not?
Well said, Adam. Thank you so much for joining us, man. Honestly, fantastic interview. Really appreciate you diving into some of these things with us and appreciate your time. Javier, any last words, man?
No, man, I'm very happy. I think we need to do a version two and a chapter two of this. This, I think, was our first hour-long interview, right?
At least with us, right?
I'm flattered that I got to kick off your newly branded show, and I look forward to coming back for part two whenever you'll have me.
Sounds good, Adam. Thank you so much, man. We will definitely talk to you soon. Appreciate it again.
Thanks, guys.
Awesome. So, Javier, real quick before we digest that, everybody stay around. In 3 minutes, we have a webinar coming up with Matt Maley. He's going to be going over to how to find stocks to trade. Information I can use personally. Oh, yeah. I'd love to hear him talk about a few cannabis stocks. But, man, what an interview with Adam. Obviously, there's a lot that went into that. He took some of the blame. He did. He took, you know, some of that, you know, I would say weight from the entire timeline of MedMen. But there are also contextual situations that probably weren't made aware to the public at that point in time that were interesting for us to hear.
Yeah, man. He's a straight shooter. I really enjoyed that. But like asking tough questions, of course, in a friendly environment, because this is our show. But you know, asking tough questions and him going like, yeah, this happened this way, this is what happened, you know, not being afraid to take some punches and, you know, return them when warranted.
Yeah. I'd love to hear what you guys think about this interview. You know, feel free to shoot us some feedback, cannabishourbusiness.com, or let us know in the comments. I think this is important for us to understand where cannabis has been, where it will go, what we can do better. Adam has helped us go through that today. But, you know, honestly, your comments are valid throughout this entire chat. We've been seeing them, and I hope you guys will continue to drop them in. We will definitely be back with some more comments, I'm sure, on Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern time at our next Cannabis Insider. Javier, always a pleasure, man.
You too, man. And by the way, go check out our list of over 100 Black-owned cannabis businesses to support, you know, MLK Week and Black History Month coming up. So support Black businesses, support Latino businesses, support women-owned businesses. Go check out our list, benzinga.com/cannabis.
And support Benzinga. BZCannabis.com for the next cannabis event. Come meet both of us in person. Woo. All right, you guys, go watch Matt Maley be a boss and pick and learn how to find stocks to trade.
We finished on time. I think this is the first time we finished on time.
You know what? We're getting better. We're getting better. Yeah. All right, y'all. We'll see you Thursday.